You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow, another ton, or lift another finger till the union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in our hearts and fire in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole.
This is the Labor Exchange on KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild, Local 37074. On tonight's episode, we are talking with Elizabeth LaBelle, local president of the American Federation of Government Employees, local number 4012. Hi, Elizabeth, and welcome to the Labor Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great. Let's start with some background. Can you start by telling our listeners a little about yourself and your union?
Yeah. So AFGE Local 4012 is a federal labor union representing three components at the Social Security Administration within the seven states that make up the Denver region. And I have been the president of Local 4012 since August of 2020. And I have been a lifelong federal employee. So representing my colleagues is something that's very important to me.
Yeah. What was your background before coming to the Social Security office?
Well, I started out as a Peace Corps volunteer, and I served in Ukraine working on youth development and education projects. I was evacuated in 2014, which is the first time Russia invaded Ukraine. And when I got home, I was picked up by Social Security and moved out to Denver to work as a claim specialist.
And what does a claim specialist do?
So we work in field operations, and we process retirement and disability applications. And we're the people that when you come into a Social Security office and you want to sit down and file for benefits, we're the person taking that application and adjudicating a decision.
You know, thinking through the Peace Corps a little bit, how do you think your work with the Social Security office ties to that volunteer work within the Peace Corps?
I think that it ties together really well, actually. Some of my youth development work was with, in Ukraine, it was called the Street Kids Project, but it was mostly children between the ages of 10 and 18 who were homeless. And so I got to experience a lot of the bureaucracy in Ukraine trying to get those kids on benefits. That way they were receiving, you know, income and things that they needed in order to survive and help take care of themselves. And I think that Social Security is kind of like the equivalent office in the United States. And so in seeing how important those benefits were to the kids that I worked with in Kharkov, I was able to kind of take that and apply it to my job now at the Social Security Administration and use some of that empathy.
Yeah. And actually thinking to my own life, when I lost my father as a child, I actually got Social Security, which both helped during that time. And then there was that which was saved for me, which, you know, went to things like college expenses or even just, you know, the first deposit on an apartment in Denver. So that's a very interesting connection there and a connection to the work. What are some of the other work that your local covers within the federal government outside of claim specialists?
Okay. So we cover, within field operations, there's three positions that we cover. So there's the claim specialists, which is what I do. And then there's the customer service representatives, and they're the people that are in the window. Usually when you come to a field office, that will help you with any benefit related questions after you've already been on benefits. And then there are claims technical experts, and there are policy specialists. So we cover those three positions within field operations. We also represent all of the disability examiners at the Office of Quality Review, and the hearing customer service representatives and hearing claims specialists in the Office of Hearing Operations.
How did your work change during the height of the pandemic, and what's it like now?
The return to the office has been definitely overwhelming for our membership, I think, and we're seeing a lot of issues within our field offices that has been kind of coming with the return to work. So right now our employees are being required to hot desk. So they don't have an assigned desk that they work at. They come in every day and it's just first come, first serve for wherever they can get a desk in the office. The agency has been saying that this is going to help prevent the spread of COVID, which doesn't make any sense to me. And we're also having a lot of issues with computer crashing in our phone system. The phone system has been a nationwide problem that is supposedly being worked on, but we've been getting a lot of dropped calls, phones not ringing when there are people waiting to, you know, speak with us and that kind of thing. And the computer crashes have been pretty challenging as well, mostly because we have a lot of employees going into the office, bringing their laptops, trying to get everything set up to work for the day, and they're spending hours waiting with on the phone with our help desk, trying to get their stations up and running. I think it's also just been the dramatic change to what was once a really flexible work schedule. We had a lot of members who reached out and were like happy about being able to telework so they could like take their afternoon break and meet their kid at the bus or something like that, that now they no longer can do that. In my particular office, there was no real change to our day-to-day other than we began working at home because my office isn't public facing. And I would also say probably that our disability examiners and quality review had a similar experience because even now that we're reopened, they're teleworking 5 days a week. But field operations, people in public facing offices, as well as hearing operations, faced some significant challenges during the pandemic. They were forced to conduct business entirely by phone in the field. And many of the people that we work with on a day-to-day basis are our most vulnerable members of society. And they can't always budget for minutes for their phone as a means to get in touch with us. And that definitely was challenging for our workforce. Our employees in hearing operations, they actually ended up seeing a big change to what their job function actually was and began doing like verbatim transcripts of hearings remotely. And so we have seen a lot of disruption because of the pandemic, but I think that our workforce has been doing the best that they can and taking every challenge and trying to turn it into a positive.
Well, and I do want to pause just to thank you and your members for, you know, doing that work throughout the pandemic. What are some of the challenges you and your members face while working in the Social Security field offices?
Right now, as offices are reopening, we're having a lot of issues, I think, generally. So maybe I should break it down. I would say that one of our more ongoing challenges has been significant issues with staffing and employee retention, especially in our Colorado field offices, as well as in our hearing office in Colorado Springs. And we're starting to see similar issues being created in Bozeman, Montana, and Salt Lake City, Utah, but they're not as pronounced as they currently are in Colorado. And unfortunately, Social Security is not really offering a living wage in Colorado, and it has subsequently been hard to get employees to take these positions. When we are able to hire people to fill these spots, we're seeing higher turnover due to an unmanageable workload, lack of proper training, and poor benefits in comparison to other federal agencies. I would say that that's probably one of our biggest challenges is staffing. Unfortunately, we just don't have as many people to be working with the public as we need. For example, our office in Fort Collins, my steward there was telling me that they're working on this rotational schedule where there's only going to be two people up front taking claims and two people at the window. That way there's adequate social distancing. But Fort Collins is a large office with a large servicing area. And so they're going to have a line out the door every single day. And so it's definitely disheartening, I believe, for our membership and knowing that, because with the pay issues that we're experiencing, if you're working at Social Security, it's because you really care about the work of the agency and you want to help the public. But unfortunately, Social Security has been ignoring the Biden executive orders, ordering them to reopen our contract for bargaining. And our current acting commissioner has been continuously declining to reinstate some of the necessary and needed benefits that were hard won under past contracts. And they were completely done away with in our 2019 agreement, or as we call it at the union, our national disagreement. So on top of these difficulties, I really do believe that our upper level management in Baltimore is just so openly hostile to our bargaining unit, especially in field operations, that they would rather see the agency cease to exist than work with the union to correct these morale issues that are driving our turnover.
Yeah. And that turnover and having trouble recruiting, you know, what are, just to put a really fine point on it, what is causing that? What are some of the key drivers within that? You touched on it a little bit.
So in the state of Colorado, we have some employees who are paid less than the state minimum wage because the federal government isn't required to follow state laws. The state can't tell the federal government what to do. And so because of that, Social Security attempts to hire and recruit people for, a claim specialist or customer support service representative. And they want you to be college educated and have all of these requirements. And then they only want to pay you $30,000 a year and live in Denver on that, or live in Colorado Springs on that. And it's really just not sustainable. And we're seeing some of these issues actually even expanding further west, where our office in Glenwood Springs doesn't even have a locality adjustment for their pay. And I think I would argue that Glenwood Springs is even more expensive to live in than Denver, truthfully. And so those employees are having a really hard time making ends meet. And as these problems get more pronounced, we're seeing turnover because our employees are like, well, I can go to Target and I can make more money an hour because Target has to follow the state minimum wage laws. So I think I'm just going to do that. And then they leave. So that's been hard.
Yeah, and I think there's the effect of trying to pay down your debt and your student loan. When I graduated in 2005, living in Denver, when rents, seemed incredibly high, but are nothing like they are now, it can be a lot that's cutting into folks. And then a lot of cities, like you mentioned, Glenwood Springs, Colorado Springs, lots of places that used to be more affordable. Although Glenwood Springs, I'm not going to say that was ever that affordable, but for those places. That seems like a huge challenge. What are some of the folks in these positions that have that commitment, that are staying in them? What are they doing to make ends meet?
Unfortunately, we've been getting a lot of information from our membership about how they've been making ends meet, and most of them are relying on welfare-related services or food banks or emergency food pantries in order to continue to feed their family.
Yeah. So as you mentioned earlier, the Social Security Administration announced recently that they're going to be reopening the field offices to the public without an appointment. They are requesting folks try to get their answers to their questions online. How do you see this affecting staff's ability to keep up with the demand?
I am already seeing it really impact the mental health of our employees because, like I said previously, if you're working for Social Security in the field office, it's because you really care about the mission of the agency. And as we're starting to open up our offices to the public, they want to serve as many members as humanly possible, but they also need to stay safe. And so we're seeing some challenges in bridging that gap between meeting customer service demands and also keeping our workforce safe. And so that has definitely been lowering morale. On top of that, field operations. So prior to the pandemic, our former commissioner had done away with telework for all field operation employees because he decided, I don't know actually why he did that, but anyway, now we're after the pandemic, we're opening up our offices, and the new commissioner wants to reinstate telework for our employees in field operations, but they're only being given 2 days of telework a week. And because of these issues with the health and safety being juxtaposed next to actually meeting our service delivery requirements, a lot of our employees have been expressing to myself and to my stewards that they feel as though this is an intentional setup to make sure that telework continues to fail. And so when we were teleworking, our employees had a lot more flexibility. They were able to save money from, not having to commute to the office and things like that. And that now that, we're back to going into the office and we're seeing these real life demands, a lot of our workforce is not handling it well.
Thinking through what can the general public do to help, if they have to be, if they need the services of the Social Security Administration.
So honestly, the biggest thing would be to go online before even going into an office. There are so many things that we really are able to do remotely. There are so many people who are eligible to request a replacement Social Security card, for example, online, and you can do that at any time of the day, not even during our hours of operation. Applications for most benefits can be filed online as well, and processed pretty expediently through one of our workload support centers. checking our website prior to coming into the office, there's a good chance that you're going to be able to find what you need there, including any forms, which would mean that you would just have to print the form out, fill it out, and mail it to us, and we would be able to process it for you that way. Because I think that trying to cut down on the amount of people that are coming into the office is ultimately going to alleviate some of the tension that we're seeing currently.
Yeah, and did you work at the Lakewood office, is that right?
I work at the workload support unit on the Denver Federal Center.
Oh, sorry, Denver Federal Center. I was actually conflating things, but I remember just again being a maybe dumb kid trying to get my Social Security card. And I was actually, you know, this again was a long time ago because probably when I was starting college, but just surprised at maybe how small the office was compared to what I had anticipated when I was going in there.
Definitely. Yeah.
You know, thinking through what do you think our federal elected officials could do to support or better support workers at the Social Security Administration and to the public you serve, which is ultimately what you've brought it back to several times?
Yeah. So I think that what our federally elected officials can do would be definitely to take a look at the general schedule and think about pay increases, even if it was just to recategorize our current positions at a higher grade level. That would definitely help with our staffing issues. And really the only people who are empowered to do that are our federally elected officials. Federal agencies don't determine their pay. That's all determined through a process with OPM and Congress and, you know, the White House kind of coming up with our general schedule. And so I also think that there should be a focus on making sure that the Social Security Administration is back to its staffing, its normal staffing levels. We've been seeing a big decline in staffing even over the past decade nationwide. And I think that we should really be doing everything in our power to bridge that gap in order to make sure that we have enough people to work with the public. Because one of the biggest complaints that we get is it takes too long to get through on the phone. It's too complicated. It's, you know, like our wait time in the office is too long and it's just too overbearing to deal with Social Security. Like it's just too bureaucratic. And so one of the easiest ways to take that out of the equation is to make sure that we have the staff that we need that's trained appropriately.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that. And that's something that I think we can ask our listeners, that if they feel that's something that they wish their elected officials would do, that it's as simple as picking up the phone and calling their offices. As folks who are there to man those phones, they definitely make sure to send that message along. And that's something that could be helpful. I did want to ask, you mentioned, you know, became president in August 2020. I'm going to say, you know, maybe a tough time to be elected as a union president, and a time of a lot of strife in the workplace in general. What made you decide to take that on?
I believe strongly in labor unions. I think that the workforce deserves someone who is going to speak up for them and look out for their best interest. And so I just have a very... I have strong feelings about unionism in general. And so there were some difficulties within our local at that time. And I decided that I was going to step up and run for president, because I guess that's kind of the basis of democracy in some ways, you know, like if you think you can do it better, you should run. And so that was kind of the mentality, and I ran with it. But it was incredibly difficult. We were under the Trump executive orders. We didn't have any official time. Our contract sucked, or still sucks, truthfully. And there's just been a lot of challenges, especially related to the pandemic, that kind of I inherited all at once. So it did take a little bit of time to get us back on course, but I think that we're doing better. And one of the things that was most important to me in taking over the position was to reignite our engagement. A union only works if we know what the problems are, and a local as big as mine is never going to know all of the problems on the ground, because I can't get 50 stewards in all of my offices, you know? So I do need to rely on our employees to tell me when there's an issue. And I think that making our presence known and making us as easily accessible as possible has been helping considerably and kind of following up on some of these workplace issues that we've been experiencing.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a unique challenge with some of the large in geographic area federal unions, where you mentioned it, Bozeman, Montana, I know Utah. What are some of the other states that you cover as well?
So the seven states are, so it's Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, Colorado, Utah, and part of Minnesota.
Yeah, and that can be a challenge, but I think what I was impressed by when we were first talking before this conversation was just the willingness to try to engage in new areas, make sure people knew that they had an opportunity to be involved. And I think in my own sort of union story, I was the treasurer of the newspaper guild for a short while. I think that was a job that at the time was a little hard to fill because it had a little work involved and not that I, you know, think I, you know, I think I had a lot of support. We have a great administrative officer that helps a lot with that, but I really tried to do my best to dig in and understand, you know, our finances so that I understood what the purpose was and that everything was really being run in the most efficient way possible. And we were seeking opportunities like new organizing. And that was one of the things that we focused on, was trying to build up some organizing capacity and has helped get some new newspapers and some other nonprofits to join the labor movement, and the way we're seeing a lot of groups around Colorado and around the nation see an opportunity in that. And you know, I kind of, like, not to put too fine a point on it, but part of why I wanted you to be on this show is because there is this term I hear in what I might call the general media of, you know, union boss. And I think people lose sight of how much of this is how democratic this truly is, and how there's opportunities for people that want to shape the union they have, if they have a union, or build one themselves by getting involved, working with their, you know, working with their fellow members and really building the vision of the union they want to be a part of.
Yeah. Definitely. I think that's so important. And I think right now too, labor has so much capital that they can act on in order to make meaningful change in the workplace. And like, now's the time, you know, I feel like that's like a, been an organizing slogan for a while, that now's the time, but it really, really is now. I mean, with the decline of labor unions, like we had seen a decline in how we handled minimum wage. I mean, our federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, and I don't know where you could live on $7.25 an hour. I don't think anywhere. So if your minimum wage is not giving someone a minimum quality of life, then it's not doing its job. That's my, you know, my opinion at least. But I think that labor unions right now are in a great position in order to capitalize on some of this and make positive workplace changes for everyone.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I think that was something that it can be surprising to people, that the federal employee would not make the minimum wage that is the official, you know, rule of the state you're in. But obviously within the federal government and within state government, there's very clear and very fierce dividing lines. But in a little bit of the time we have left, I did want to return to your volunteer work with the Peace Corps in Ukraine and ask you what your experience was like, and if it gives you any insight into the current conflict in Ukraine.
Definitely. So I was stationed in eastern Ukraine, and I lived in a village outside of Kharkov. And I worked in Kharkov primarily on our with youth development. But I had a really positive experience there. I really love Ukraine. I love the Ukrainian culture and the people. I mean, there were some things that definitely were like very frustrating to work through when I first showed up. The reality is, like, Ukraine is a beautiful country. And one of the things that struck me about Ukraine was that the shift from communism to free market, it didn't occur as well as it probably could have. And because of that, I think that the Ukrainian government was experiencing a lot of challenges with funding and not being able to supply necessary benefits to the Ukrainian people that were definitely needed. even if it was just like support services for their homeless population. Like in Kharkiv, at the time that I was there, my nonprofit I was working at was the only nonprofit that worked with homeless individuals in most of Eastern Ukraine. And that's just not going to cut it. Like there needs to be more systems in place in order to help vulnerable members of society. But one of the first things, actually recently when Russia really invaded Ukraine was, one of the things that when Russia really did invade Ukraine, most recently that I was the most concerned about was the infrastructure. Ukraine has not the best infrastructure when it comes to like electricity or even just traveling generally. Like the motorways aren't super well kept up. There's like a lot of potholes. People kind of drive like serpentine around them because they're so problematic. And my biggest concern was, well, how is it that the people that I love are going to get out of this country because they can barely get from one city to another the way it's currently set up? And so I think that was probably one of my biggest concerns when I read that news. But I was able to get in touch with some of the people from my village that I still talk to. And as of right now, they are okay. But it's been difficult, especially for individuals who are sick or experiencing like complications from COVID. Like the medical infrastructure in Ukraine is definitely lacking. One of my counterpart in Ukraine, her daughter is still in Kharkiv and she can't go anywhere because she's having difficulty getting portable oxygen, which she needs after having COVID. So she's confined to her apartment in Kharkiv, which is actively not safe. It's not a safe place to be. And she can't leave because she can't get the medical equipment that she needs.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you being, you know, maybe a little vulnerable on that and sharing some of the it's easy when you're thinking about conflict to take your own life and try to superimpose it on that and think, okay, well, you know, if I'm trying to get from point A to point B, you know, these are the steps I would take, but then realizing that you know, we're not, these things don't happen without, you know, an underlying reality that's already there, and that might not be the experience that folks who aren't actually familiar with the location, you know, would be able to truly understand. And you know, I do want to take a minute just to thank you for sharing, and hope that that those in Ukraine are doing the best they can to survive an incredibly tough situation.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. And even just thinking a little bit about, you know, how challenging it can be to be in a place where you know you're safe and you know others are not. And that's, yeah, pretty, you know, pretty harrowing thing to say. So getting myself a little bit verklempt here, knowing that my great grandpa never told a story without a tear in his eye. So I'm okay with it a little bit, but you know, certainly challenging to really let yourself emotionally think about those things. When the last about minute that we have, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to wrap up and maybe any final thoughts that you'd like our listeners to hear.
Well, thank you so much for having me on this show. That way I can get some of the information out about what our Social Security employees are facing and experiencing every day when they go into the office. But we would absolutely appreciate if you reached out to your elected officials to discuss our pay and staffing issues. I think that would be an enormous help to my employees on the ground. But I think that's everything.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Elizabeth LaBelle with the AFGE Local 4012. This has been the Labor Exchange on KGNU. Thank you.